Lecture 39, The Family.
Hello and welcome to Lecture 39 of our History of Ancient Rome. We're in the thematic section of the course, and what I wish to do in this lecture is examine the Roman family, the basic building block of Roman society. Before commencing to look at the Roman family in a bit more detail, we should look at the definition, the problems of defining the term family. It is, in any culture, a flexible term. If you were to ask an Italian person what a family was, and then ask the same question of a Dane or a Swede, you would get a very different answer. Even within a culture, the term has a certain flexibility of application. If you ask a 15-year-old boy how his family is, he might relate about his parents and his brothers and sisters. But then ask the same question of a 50-year-old man married with three children, and again, you're going to get a very different answer. So the word family itself is flexible both between cultures and even within cultures. This is certainly the case for the Roman term familia, the Latin term, which is used often to describe what we would consider a family unit, but it covers much more than the modern nuclear family that we would consider covered broadly by the word family. It seems that the phrase familia in Latin can apply not just to the mother and father and the children, the nuclear family of modern conception, but also to the extended family members, uncles, aunts, cousins, and even to clients, non-blood relatives, but people who were attached to the family unit, clients, and even sometimes the slaves that are living in the household. And as a further extension, just to illustrate how flexible this term could be, the word familia was often applied to groups of people who were not related by blood in any way at all, such as groups of gladiators or groups of slaves who worked in the same section of the house or in the same area of the estate could be called a familia. So its basic, its root meaning seems to be basically people who know each other, people who are familiar with each other, who deal with each other a lot. And so that's a very, very flexible term indeed. Nonetheless, for ease of reference, I will use the word family to describe this basic unit of Roman society. Another word, by the way, that the Romans could use to describe a family unit, an extended family unit, was household, domus, which nicely encapsulates the concept since it describes all those people who share the living space of the house. Domus means a house, but it can also mean a household, as in the people who live in the house. And that could also be used to designate people that we would designate with the word family. In the ancient world, and especially as well in the Roman context, the most fundamental formative factor in establishing family relationships was the issue of land and land ownership. Land was fundamental to the welfare of any group of people in the ancient world. If you had land, you could grow food and raise flocks and herds and so on to feed yourself and your family. If you didn't have land, then there was no welfare system to fall back on as such. You were destitute. You either had to become a dependent of someone else and become a tenant on someone else's land, or in the worst case scenario, you had to sell yourself into slavery or go and join the landless urban mob in Rome or in some nearby urban center. So the issue of land ownership was a fundamental one for the welfare of the ancients. And since in the Mediterranean basin, as a whole, taking a broader perspective than just the Roman world and going back before the Roman era, it was quite common for land to be passed down within a family and for it, in fact, to be illegal to sell land outside of the family. This is called the inalienability of land. It must stay within the family. As a result of that circumstance and the essential use of land, essentialness of land for the welfare of the family, land ownership often was a crucial formative factor in forming family relationships. That, of course, can be said to apply, that circumstance can be said to apply especially to upper class families, especially families who owned lots of land. Then, for sure, keeping the land in the family and trying to extend the patrimony, especially through marriage alliances, something that we'll see in a minute, was a crucial factor. But for the lower orders, say a shop owner or a craftsman, that would be a less important and less determinative factor in shaping family relationships. So as a result, we should also draw, before going into the details, a broad distinction between upper class family relationships and lower class family relationships. As should be clear to everyone by now from knowledge of the nature of our sources for the ancient Roman world, most of our comments are going to have to be directed at the upper class Roman family since we have so little evidence about how the lower classes live their lives. So looking at the upper class Roman family, another crucial feature of the Roman family that would strike us as somewhat odd and was a very distinctive feature of the Roman mentality was the emphasis placed upon the position of the ancestors, who were termed the maiores, literally the major ones, the ones older in age, the ones who had come before. We've seen how already, in looking at the Roman Republic and the shape of the Roman Constitution, the so-called mos maiorum, the way of the ancestors, the way of the past, was a very important consideration in how the Romans ran their entire state, how they ran their government. Well, this was a public extension of an essentially private circumstance in which individual families not quite worshipped, but certainly revered the memories of their ancestors. Since it was the ancestors who had established the patrimony of the family, it was the ancestors who had established the family's position in the state. You may have had ancestors who were consuls or censors who had been great generals. These people were extremely important to the Roman family. And they were important in a very immediate way. Busts of the ancestors were kept around the family house. Not just busts, but waxen death masks. Masks actually taken from the dead faces of the maiores were preserved and kept in a special sort of a shrine inside the family living quarters, inside the house. And these death masks, they're called imagines, these waxen death masks would be taken out on funerals in an extremely unusual way, as described by Polybius, who witnessed some of these upper-class aristocratic Roman funerals. At a Roman funeral, the family would come out, obviously, to mourn the death of an important member of the family. Now, this would apply, of course, to an important man, a leading man of the family. The family would come out and a eulogy would be delivered, usually by the eldest son or a close relative if the eldest son wasn't around, eulogizing the achievements of the dead man. But in the procession itself, it seems, the waxen death masks were taken out of the shrine and put on the faces of men, actors who were of the same broad build and physical shape as the ancestors whose masks they were wearing were supposed to have been. And in this way, then, it's as if the ancestors were resurrected and came out to show their support and respect for the achievement of the dead member of the family. And Polybius comments that this was a tremendous stimulus for the younger generation of this family to try and emulate the achievements of their betters. He doesn't mention, which I'm sure modern psychologists will be interested to know, how much was it a crushing burden of expectation on those young men, but that wasn't something that Polybius was willing to entertain. He just presents it as a tremendous stimulus for the young men to emulate. So the notion of the ancestors then, the maiores, was also a powerful one in shaping the behaviour and the relationships of the upper-class Roman family. The Roman family also differed from the modern in several other important respects. I'll mention just a few of them. For instance, the upper-class marriage was rarely based on a union of love and mutual respect. These are two characteristics that we consider fundamental to a successful marriage in the modern world. It was very rarely a determining effect in forming unions among upper-class Roman families. Rather, the really important considerations were political alliances, as we've seen, for instance, with the marriage of Caesar's daughter Julia to Pompey to seal the so-called First Triumvirate, or the use of Augustus's daughter, also called Julia, to assist in his dynastic aspirations for the imperial succession in the imperial age. Or they could be as well for economic benefit. It might be useful for a family, for two major families to join together to make their mutual patrimony grow larger, to get their hands on more land. So as a result of this then, upper class Roman marriages tended more or less to be what we would call arranged marriages. Often children would be betrothed, and I mean children, infants often would be betrothed at the age of 3 or 4 to each other. The fathers would agree, your son would make a good husband when he's old enough for my daughter who's here, who's 3. And these betrothals would often finally manifest themselves as marriages. Secondly, the marriages, when they took place, were often between a mature man who would have had to spend some time in the army and maybe establish himself in public life and might be in his mid-20s or early 30s, and a young girl of an age that we would consider to be almost criminal. Girls of 14, 15 and 16 often found themselves married to men 30 and 35 and older. So this situation also created a very interesting and different relationship between husbands and wives than we would expect. The idea of being married to a teenager is certainly a somewhat unusual one, but one can see how in that situation the prospects for a relationship of mutual love and intellectual respect and so on is going to be somewhat restricted when you have a young girl of 15 or 16 and a fully mature man with experience in public life. The difference in age alone is going to help change the nature of the marriage. And this is why on Roman gravestones, one of the features of marriage that's praised again and again, is one of the features of a successful marriage, is concordia, harmony, lack of argument in the household. Rarely do we hear about, necessarily about love and respect, but we hear a lot about a good marriage is marked by concordia. I'm not saying that Roman husbands and wives didn't love each other. That, of course, could in fact be the case, and probably was the case a lot more among the lower classes. But it is interesting that concordia, harmony, peacefulness is one of the features that is praised specifically again and again in gravestones to mark a successful marriage. Relationships, obviously, within a Roman family were also as status-bound and hierarchical as was generally the case in Roman society as a whole. A wide variety of relationships could exist, status relationships between husband and wife, father and eldest son, and then subsequent children, the chief woman of the house versus the in-laws and the owners and the slaves, and then again, of course, within the slave hierarchy, as we also saw in a previous lecture. So plenty of hierarchical and status-bound relationships existing as well within the Roman household. Two illustrations are particularly apt, I think, in showing us that the Roman family was quite a different sort of a place from what we would expect from the modern family. Today, newlyweds are expected to leave the house and form their own household, go off and buy a house and start raising their own family. In the ancient world, a newlywed couple moved into the house of the groom's father, so that the bride became a member of the groom's familia. More of that in a minute. And secondly, among upper class Romans, slaves were often used to raise the children of the family. These slaves could be called nutriques, wet nurses, or they could be called paedagogi if they were male, child minders. And they were often used to deal with the mundane, everyday business of raising children. So that the relationship between the parents and especially infant children in a Roman family was a bit more distant than we would consider even healthy, I suppose, in our psychologically oriented view of how families should be operating. That distance wouldn't be considered healthy. But why that came about, it's hard to say. Perhaps it was a product of the circumstance of frequent death in childbirth for women. Perhaps it was a natural offshoot of that, that slaves were a natural substitute for mothers who didn't make it out of childbirth. We do hear a lot of women died in childbirth again. Julia, Caesar's daughter and Pompey's wife, died in childbirth in 54 BC. And Pliny refers to two sisters from the same family who died together in childbirth only a few weeks apart. So this was quite a common occurrence, and maybe the use of slaves to raise children had arisen in that context. That's certainly one idea put forward by scholars. And another idea is that it was simply considered below the dignity of a upper-class Roman woman to deal with the messy and mundane business of raising an infant, and that was considered more appropriate as slave labor, a menial task that was appropriate to a slave. Whatever the case, it is a feature of Roman family life, upper-class Roman family life, that is, that slaves were often used to raise young children. The most distinctive characteristic of Roman family life was the absolute dominance of the eldest living male over everyone living in his household. The eldest living male of a Roman house, the patriarch of a Roman family, was termed the pater familias, literally the father of the family. And in legal authorities, he exercises what's termed patria potestas, a very interesting term, fatherly power, potestas. It's the same word that's used to describe, for instance, the tribunician power, the tribunicia potestas of emperors. This is a legally conferred power. This is a powerful and potent word. That's the word that the Romans used to describe the power of the father, of the pater familias, over all those living under his roof. It was actually a legally conferred potestas power. Allied to it was the notion of the guiding hand, manus, which means also means that which is in one's hand, and so it means that over which you have authority, and so it can just mean authority on occasion. These two features were the dominant qualities of the Roman pater familias. He had absolute control and a guiding hand in all of the family's affairs. By absolute control, I'm not exaggerating. In legal sources, it's clear that the pater familias had the right to beat, kill, or sell into slavery anyone living under his roof, wife or children. He also owned all the property of anyone who fell under his potestas. So he owned the property of his children and of his grandchildren as long as he was alive. All the property of the family, in other words, fell under the potestas of the pater familias, fell into the hands of the patriarch of the household. This is clearly a product of the land-based relationships that I mentioned earlier, that a guiding hand is needed. A single person must dictate the welfare of the entire family to ensure its survival into the following generation. The absolute primacy of the pater familias is not only written into the laws, and it shows up, by the way, in our very earliest body of written law, Roman law, the 12 Tables, which was published in 450 and 449 BC. Right there, Table 4 of the 12 Tables is entirely concerned with establishing the dominance of the pater familias over all members of his household. It undoubtedly goes back even further into the ancient past. It didn't just appear in 450 or 449 BC. Rather, the laws are an expression, it appears, of a long-standing situation that goes back into the archaic past. But right there in the 12 Tables, in Table 4 of the 12 Tables, the father is abjured, or at least allowed, to kill, to form children, sell people under his potestas into slavery if they behave badly, and to have his property protected against interlopers and illegitimate claims on it. So again, land ownership always at the root of the position of the pater familias. Throughout all of Roman history, however, this archaic feature of the Roman family, the absolute power, legal power, of the pater familias over those living in his potestas was never impugned by law. It was never, ever restricted by law. The primacy of the pater familias is well reflected in the system of Roman nomenclature, in the way that Romans were named, because basically the pater familias is the one who gave his name to all children and grandchildren that issued out of his house. And this can lead to rather bizarre situations whereby you have, for instance, a family like the Servilii Caepiones, who were called Quintus Servilius Caepio. And as you go down through the family tree of these people, who were prominent in the 2nd and 1st centuries BC, the first man is Quintus Servilius Caepio. His son is called Quintus Servilius Caepio. And his son is called Quintus Servilius Caepio. And his son, after that, in four generations, they're all called Quintus Servilius Caepio. The eldest son has the same name going down to four generations. Also, by the way, a desire to lay claim to the dignitas and prominence and heritage of the maiores, of the ancestors. That's part of the reason why the same names were used. I mean, why change the name? If it's worked for me, it might as well work for you. And women were only called by the main name in the Roman three-name system. So all women born of Quintus Servilius Caepio and his children were just called Servilia. They only had one name, and they were called Servilia. So you could have multiple daughters, and they're all called Servilia. It seems very strange to us, but the important point is that the pater familias is the one who's giving his name to both male and female children going down in the generations. As an aside, by the way, to avoid confusion, abject confusion among women of the same family who have the same name, sometimes the women could be given extra names like Servilia Maior, Servilia the Elder, Servilia Minor, Servilia the Younger, or Servilia Tertia, Servilia the Third Servilia, and so on and so forth, or Servilia Quarta, the fourth one, so as to be able to identify them from each other. But their basic name was always just derived from the main name of the nomen, the clan name of the pater familias of the house. Patria potestas, the power of the father, only lapsed in the case of the death of the patriarch of the pater familias, and then it passed on to the eldest son, who then became the pater familias of the family. it could sometimes be voluntarily released. People could be released from patria potestas by the desire of the paterfamilias if he so wished. If the circumstances were to be profitable to the family, that could be done. In cases of insanity, it was usually considered to be suspended until either the person was dead or until he recovered from the insanity, and then it was brought back into action. So that's the situation in the law. But we must be clear that legalities are all well and good. Legalities are a useful avenue into examining aspects of the ancient world, but they don't really describe the full reality of life. No one would claim, for instance, that our modern divorce laws actually capture the experience and all the complexities of divorce in our society. They only describe what's allowed and what's not allowed. So for the actual operation of the patria potestas and the potentially tyrannical powers of the paterfamilias, we have to look to the Romans, who wrote about what it was like living in this system. And what we find is, again and again, despite the fact that there are some pretty nasty examples on record, usually from the legendary past, the head of a household, the paterfamilias, is rarely presented as a tyrannical figure who's executing his wives and selling his children into slavery. As I said, I mean, there are examples of this, usually from the legendary past. Probably a very striking example would be the case of Marcus Junius Brutus, the man who was supposed to have founded the Republic in 509 BC. We saw how his sons had actually conspired to bring back the Tarquin dynasty, and Brutus oversaw their execution, ordered and oversaw their execution. Now, there's something of an overlap between Brutus' position as a defender of liberty, a public official defending the liberty of the Republic, and his position as a father exercising patria potestas over rebel children. But the example was often cited by Romans in the context of illustrating the severitas, the severity of a father over members of his family. In real life, examples, historical examples of fathers behaving as tyrants over their children are extremely few and far between. And several circumstances must have combined to limit the possibility of a tyrannical paterfamilias exercising his authority nastily and abusing it over generations of his offspring. In the first place, the life expectancy in the ancient world was extremely low. Men could, of course, reach great ages. We've seen people who've reached into the 80s and 90s, which is some achievement for the ancient world. But those people are very much the rarity. The idea that a son could live to full maturity and raise a family and still have a father exercising authority over him, that was undoubtedly a rarity. That must have been a rarity. Fathers must have died off a lot younger and allowed the patria potestas to pass on to their sons without necessarily exercising a control over them. A good exception, by the way, is the story that stands behind Cicero's speech in defense of Roscius of Ameria. Here is a guy who was charged with murdering his own father, and the prosecution had alleged that he murdered the father precisely for this reason, that the father had parked this son, who was a middle-aged guy now, in his 40s, had parked him on the farm in the town, in the hometown of Ameria, while the father went off to Rome to enjoy the high life, partied with the best of them by all accounts. And that eventually alleged the prosecution, the defendant Roscius, Sextus Roscius, murdered his father, who was unsurprisingly also called Sextus Roscius, murdered his father, arranged to have him murdered so as to get out from under the oppressive fatherly power. Well, Cicero painted a much more complex and rather more conspiratorial picture than that and managed to get his client off. But that situation, that basic situation that the prosecution in this case seems to have painted of a fully mature, middle-aged man chafing under the patria potestas of an aged, in this case, high-living father, is very much the rarity. And that would be a product of low life expectancy. Secondly, custom also intervened to limit the exercise of patria potestas. It became increasingly less the case that fathers of families would just randomly sell children into slavery. For instance, one circumstance that arose was in severe cases when a father was considering exercising his legal rights in a severe way over his children, for instance, it was normal to summon a family council. It wasn't legally prescribed. This is a social custom. But one was summon a family council, debate the case, and usually the family council's decision would be considered binding on the father, even though legally the father had the right to act as he saw fit. So again, custom here has to be taken into account. We can't just look only at the law, which is a bit distorting in terms of its presentation of these relationships. Cicero, for instance, had some trouble with his teenaged children, and we hear about them in the letters, and he doesn't invoke patria potestas. He tries other ways to solve the problems. He doesn't immediately resort to beating, killing, or send them into slavery. This is not something that happened as a matter of course. And finally, there were just generally widely held taboos on certain patterns of behaviour. Although, again, it was legally within the rights of a paterfamilias to beat his wife if he saw fit, it was considered completely unacceptable socially for that to go on, and anyone who did that would be socially ostracised and would, of course, suffer a loss of status. And we've seen already how important status was to the Roman upperclassmen. So there were taboos on selling children into slavery or beating one's wife. Taboos of social custom that limited the application of patria potestas. Nevertheless, it must be mentioned, it remained in force legally throughout Roman history. So we have to conclude that while it seems to us to be an extremely restrictive and rather backward sort of system, this idea of having a patriarch with such an absolute legal power and control over members of his family, it appears to have worked well for the Romans. And as I say, it can't be stressed strongly enough, the examples of abuse of the patria potestas and of the authority of the head of the house over those living under his control, examples of that are extremely few and far between. And I think it's rather interesting that so many of them are legendary. They take place in the legendary past. They're almost like moral tales, almost like the sorts of things that probably people told their children at night to make sure that they behaved well the next day. But the actual examples of them in historical times are extremely few and far between. And the whole system seems to work quite well, for all it seems to us to be rather oppressive and restrictive.
Lecture 40, Women in Roman Society.
Hello, and welcome to Lecture 40 of our History of Ancient Rome, in which we're going to examine the position of women in Roman society. In the last lecture, we looked at Roman families and family life, laying emphasis especially on the pater familias, on the male patriarch of the Roman family. So it's time now to look at the other side of the coin and look at the experience of Roman women. Roman women were, in the Roman ideal anyway, naturally assigned to the domestic sphere, so it's a rather logical extension, having looked at families, to now examine the position of women. We will, however, see that by no means were all Roman women confined to the house, but that's something that we'll get to in the course of today's lecture. Before proceeding, perhaps something of a caveat should be issued. That is the warning that it is perhaps misleading in some ways to examine women independently of their menfolk. Whatever status upper-class women earned, whatever deference they felt due to themselves was due primarily to their menfolk and the prominence and status that the menfolk, their husbands or their brothers or their fathers, had earned. And so as a result, Roman women, so far as we can tell, would have shared the social attitudes of the particular class to which they belonged. And the experience of the consul's wife and the kitchen maid, for instance, would have been worlds apart. Because they were women, doesn't make their experience similar in any way. There's no evidence either that Roman women felt a sisterhood across status grades, that the consul's wife would have felt an affiliation with the slave maid working in the kitchen. So with that warning aside, I'll reiterate once more that for the most part, Roman women derived their status, whatever status that they earned, they derived from reference to the men in their lives. That said, it is the case that certain laws and attitudes did pertain to women just by virtue of their gender alone. All freeborn women, for instance, in Roman law, were required at all times in their lives to be under guardianship, to be under the care of some man or other. Naturally, daughters would be born into the patria potestas of their father, just as their brothers would have been. But when daughters got married, especially if they got married by means of an old, very ancient form of marriage in Roman custom called the confariatio, the marriage of the far cake, I'll explain it in a minute. If they got married with this procedure, then they passed from the manus, from the authority of their father, into the manus and the authority of their husband. And if the husband had his father still living, then the bride naturally fell under the potestas of her father-in-law. If a marriage was dissolved, then the woman would go back to the potestas of her father, or would have a legal guardian appointed if none could be found, if there was no obvious person for her to return under the potestas of, under the authority of, then one would be appointed by law. This marriage ceremony, by the way, the confariatio, was an interesting one. It was the oldest one in Roman society, and it did mark a legal transfer of manus, the woman moving from one realm of authority into another. And it was so called, it was called confariatio because the chief element of the ritual was the breaking of a sacred cake called a far, which was broken over an altar with prayers being said to Jupiter and Juno, and then the cake was shared, was eaten by the bride and the groom, and that symbolized their marriage and their union. It was the only form of Roman marriage which could not be dissolved by a divorce in any way. But by the first century BC, it had largely fallen out of use, and other forms of marriage that did not involve transfer of manus, the legal transfer of manus, the legal transfer of authority, had become more popular. Nevertheless, the women were, all women, freeborn women, were considered to fall under the authority of some male, whether it was their husband or their father or some legally appointed guardian. Again, that's a legal position, and we'll see that there are differences between the legalities and the realities of the experience of Roman women. An interesting feature of the Roman woman's position, and one that differs remarkably from most other ancient Mediterranean societies, was the fact that Roman women could own property in their own right. And this was one feature of the legal position of women that allowed them some degree of independence and power in Roman society, more than was the case for, say, women in classical Greek society, in most ancient Mediterranean societies. A good example of this is the story, this is an interesting story that I quite like to tell, of a scam that was attempted between a senator and his mistress sometime, probably in the first century BC. In this story, the senator falls very ill, and his mistress decides to arrange, with the connivance of the senator, arrange for an inheritance in his will in the region of 300,000 sesterces, a very significant sum of money. And she arranges for this inheritance by forging in her own records a loan to the senator, which she can then reclaim from his estate when he's dead. But unfortunately for all concerned, the senator recovered from his illness. The woman, however, did not give up. The mistress then sued him for the money on the pretense that the forgery was actually real. She lost the case. But it's a good example of the way that, first of all, women could actually inherit money in wills. It's a regular feature of Roman wills to name daughters and other women as people who inherit property and money in wills. And also of the power of the woman, in that she's then able to initiate a lawsuit. Obviously, through menfolk, she would initiate the lawsuit, but it's all done on her behalf against a senator of all people. So this is obviously a person of considerable power and independence. Even more striking is the issue of the dowry, this being a rather odd type of a behaviour. It's basically a package of usually money or property that travels with the bride from the bride's family to the groom's family when a marriage takes place. It seems in origin to have been a contribution by the bride's family for the upkeep, for the expenses of the upkeep of the bride, since, as we've seen before, the bride went into the house of the husband. What's interesting, though, in Roman law is that the dowry stays with the bride. It remains the bride's property, even if the husband has access to it technically it's still the bride's property. So we hear, for instance, of Cato the Elder complaining bitterly of how unscrupulous wives will lend money to their husbands from their dowries and then use the loans as leverage to extract concessions from them and harass them, demanding the money be paid back and so forth to gain power over their husbands. So the dowry stayed with the bride and didn't become the property either of the husband or of the husband's family. On dissolution of marriages, even if the bride was at fault, all or part of the dowry had to be repaid to the bride's family and to the bride when she left the household. So for instance, Cicero divorced his wife in 48 BC, Terentia, and he had, we hear from his letters, considerable trouble trying to raise the money to pay her back her dowry, which was now due. He had spent the money in the interim and now had to pay it back. It's clear from the evidence that Roman women could own property in their own right, and the case of the dowry is a particularly illustrative example of that. It was property that went with the bride in and out of marriages. On the whole, it can also be said that women were viewed by men, generally speaking, in ways that we would term today sexist. They were considered to be weaker, less reasonable, more prone to giving in to the passions of the flesh, and as a result, not entirely trustworthy, not as capable, generally, as men. And these attitudes, I think the best explanation for these attitudes is that they derive from the circumstance, once again, of land ownership and the maintenance of the patrimony within the family. And the need in very ancient times to maintain a close watch on the behaviour of women in the household to ensure that no illegitimate children would arise who could lay claim to any portion of the family's patrimony. So these attitudes, it would seem, then stem from the fundamental characteristics that we've already examined in relation to the Roman family relations of land ownership and the passage of land and property down through the family. But these attitudes were very widespread, and women were generally considered to be less capable, less reasonable, more promiscuous and so forth than men were. Once more, the situation among the lower orders is more difficult to discern. Here, men and women would undoubtedly have shared much labour, and as a result, it may have, conditions of the relationship between men and women in the lower orders may have been quite different, but that's something we'll come back to at the end of the lecture. Once again, however, if we return to the question of guardianship, we shouldn't be misled entirely by the legal sources. It's quite clear to us that women in the late Republic especially, and again in the early Empire, could earn positions of considerable respect and independence and power even in their societies. We hear, for instance, of, in many ways, a woman who's held up as a paradigm of propriety in Roman sources, Cornelia, the mother of the Gracchi. She had an immense status by virtue of being the daughter of Publius Cornelius Scipio Africanus, the man who had defeated Hannibal. So she emanates from a very prominent Roman family on her father's side. She then married Tiberius Sempronius Gracchus, a man who became consul twice and was a censor. So she also derived prominence from her husband. And then she gave birth, among her 12 children, she gave birth to the two Gracchi brothers, who, although they were somewhat notorious, were nonetheless prominent and important people. And so she also derived some respect from her son. So she was hedged about by prominent menfolk. But her behaviour as well and her whole demeanour was considered exemplary, and we'll look at that in a minute when we examine the male ideal of womanhood in the Roman world. But suffice it to say for the moment that Cornelia, the mother of the Gracchi, was a woman of considerable prominence and respect in the society of her day. Even more striking, of course, are the imperial women of the Julio-Claudian and later imperial dynasties. I could tell endless stories about them. Unfortunately, we don't have the time or space to do so. But we've already seen, for instance, the rumours surrounding Augustus' wife Livia, which portray her as sort of an evil murderess, paving the way for her own son Tiberius to succeed upon Augustus' death. And we've seen that those rumours are probably baseless for the most part, but the fact that they're there at all tells you that here's a person who's publicly recognized as a woman of considerable power and influence, even if it is one that's exercised behind the scenes. Also, there was the daughter of Augustus Julia, who served as a clear marker of successors to the Roman imperial position of princeps. She was married three times, and all three of her husbands were designated as successors of the Emperor Augustus. She fell from grace in 2 BC, however, when she had a series of love affairs with various people and ended up living on a small island for the rest of her life, put there by her father, who refused ever to countenance her return to Rome subsequently. And likewise, her daughter, also called Julia, so Augustus's granddaughter, was also a person of some prominence who also ended up on a small island elsewhere in the Mediterranean in AD 8, similarly for having love affairs. The point here, of course, is that the love affairs of imperial princesses carry with them important political ramifications, because they risk precisely what I believe lies at the source of so many of the negative attitudes that men held towards women. They risk bringing outsiders into the dynasty and threatening the clear succession down the Julian and Claudian lines, just as in more mundane circumstances the sexual promiscuity of members of a family risked bringing outsiders into the family and threatening the inheritance of the family property. That's why these women suffered as they did, but they were nonetheless highly prominent people, as were lots of other imperial women. As I said before, were very well informed about the Julio-Claudian dynasty, were not so well informed about others, but there's no reason to expect that the wives of other emperors, about whom we hear less, were any less influential or any less important in their societies. We do get snippets. For instance, the wife of Trajan, Plotina by name, seems to have single-handedly orchestrated the succession of the next emperor, Hadrian, in AD 117. Her husband Trajan died of a fever in the east quite suddenly, and Hadrian was adopted by Trajan, we hear. That whole arrangement orchestrated by Plotina. We suspect that there was some underhand play, since the adoption of Hadrian by Trajan took place the day after Trajan's death, which would suggest that indeed Plotina had orchestrated the whole affair. And other emperors' wives, the wife of the emperor Septimius Severus, a woman called Julia Domna, was extremely prominent. She would even hear petitions and meet embassies that came to see her husband. So all throughout then imperial history, wives and princesses of the emperors were people of considerable prominence. Again, though, deriving their prominence and their power from reference to their husbands, because technically Roman women were debarred from taking part in public life. There was no threat of there ever being a female consul during the Republic or an empress who would rule independently of a man. That never happened in Roman history. But that imperial women and consuls' wives and so forth could exercise behind-the-scenes influence, that shouldn't be doubted for a second. In the male ideal, Roman duties of Roman women were to be kept far from the public eye. They were to be involved in organizing the household. In the male ideal, again, this is reconstructible from the ancient written evidence, which is all of it written by men. In the male ideal, a woman moved from being a puella, a young girl, to being a virago, a maiden, and then eventually to being, hopefully, to being a matrona, a matron, a woman who had given birth to several children and had a successful marriage, preferably to someone of prominence. A person who was a matrona was automatically due a certain amount of respect and deference. This woman had earned status. Regardless of the age of the woman, whether a puella, a girl, or a matrona, a matron, the most prized quality, at least in the male ideal of womanhood, that any woman could have was pudicitia, which is an almost untranslatable term, but basically is sort of a combination of modesty, chastity, fidelity, and fertility, all combined and rolled into one. Ideally, a Roman woman should be educated enough to be able to hold her own in a conversation, but not overly educated so that she might get into a shouting match with dinner guests or something, or prove all the men at a dinner party wrong on some important point of philosophy. That wouldn't go down well, but she should be sufficiently educated to take part and contribute in conversation. She should be agreeable, without being overly friendly, of course. And, of course, at all times, she should have an eye to her pudicitia, her modesty, and her standing in the state. Again, Cornelia, the mother of the Gracchi, was in many ways the paradigm of these characteristics. She was well known as being an entertaining raconteur, an educated woman who could tell stories, of course, from her own family's history and her husband's family's history. After her husband died, she was courted by many prominent Romans and even the king of Egypt, but she stayed loyal to the memory of her husband. There's the element of fidelity. And she also exercised a modest influence over her sons, reprimanding her youngest son Gaius, apparently, for some of his political acts. And generally was so well respected that she's one of the few women that we know of to have had a statue erected in a public space at public expense by a decree of the Senate. So she was in many ways held up then as a paradigm of what the Roman matron should be. She was the embodiment of the male ideal of womanhood. Women who, of course, crossed the line here, who didn't behave like this, were subject to severe opprobrium, and several examples will suffice. I've mentioned Clodia before. She was the sister of the renegade tribune Publius Clodius Pulcher, and was probably the subject of Catullus's love poems, who uses the pseudonym Lesbia for her. Now, the identification is not 100%, but most scholars would agree that the Lesbia of Catullus's love poems is Clodia, this woman. She was a person vilified at length by Cicero in one of his forensic speeches. He blames this woman for orchestrating the framing of the person he was defending at the time, a man called Marcus Caelius Rufus. And the picture that comes across, once you read between the lines and accept that Cicero was painting the worst possible picture of her, but the picture that comes across of Clodia is of a very powerful, independent, and in Cicero's eyes, notorious woman, instantly recognizable in higher Roman society, conducting her own affairs as she saw fit, taking lovers and dropping them as she saw fit, one of them being the poet Catullus, and basically behaving in a way that is very independent and free, although it is contrary to the male ideal and so subject to considerable scorn. Another excellent example is from the writings of the historian Sallust, who describes the Catilinarian conspiracy in one of his monographs. And in one of the chapters of this monograph, he turns his mind to one of the conspirators who was a woman, Sempronia. And he writes of her as follows. He says, Sempronia had often in the past acted with a masculine daring and boldness. Yet fortune had blessed her quite adequately, first with beauty and good birth, and then with a husband and children. She had studied Greek and Latin literature. She could play the lyre and dance, although with more skill than is necessary for an honest woman. And she had many other talents which lead to moral dissipation. But there was nothing she valued less than honour and decency. It would be difficult to decide which she squandered more, her money or her reputation. She was so filled with burning lust that she more often made advances to men than they did to her. Even before meeting Catiline, she had often broken promises, dishonored credit agreements, been an accessory to murder, and plunged headlong into poverty because of her extravagance. And yet, her abilities were far from contemptible. She could write poetry, be droll, converse modestly or tenderly or coarsely, as the situation demanded. In fact, she was a woman of great wit and great charm. Sallust's closing statement there, she was a woman of great wit and great charm, has led some to suspect that Sallust was more than familiar with the charms and wit of Sempronia, and there's an element of bitterness in the passage, but it illustrates well the ways that Sempronia transgressed what were considered to be the proper boundaries for female behaviour. She could play the lyre and dance, but she did so too well than was necessary. She was a good conversationalist, but overly so. She could be coarse and unbecoming, and so on and so forth. It's worth noting, however, in passing that similar ideals, well, not similar, but analogous ideals attached to men. It's not as if men could behave as they wished in Roman society. We've already seen the expectation placed upon men by the maiores within the family. So there were certainly distinct roles for men and women, and all we've been examining here are the roles that were designated as appropriate for women, at least in the male ideal. So despite the essentially domestic nature then of the male ideal of the woman's role in society, it's quite clear from a variety of sources that women could earn positions of public prominence, and not just indirectly. When we travel out into the municipalities and cities of the empire and examine the epigraphic and the inscriptional evidence from those places, we can find evidence of prominent women in their localities. Again, we mustn't be misled by the legal sources into believing that the legal sources describe the realities. Let's go out and look at the realities, and what we find is that women could attain positions of considerable prominence in the various towns and municipalities of the Roman Empire. Some inscriptions, for instance, are dedications by the local town councils in honour of specific women. They just say, the town council honors this woman. You will usually say whose father was this prominent person, whose husband is this prominent person. Nonetheless, here is an inscription which is at the base of a statue of the woman in a public place, put up at local town expense in honor of the woman herself. And the township would not do that unless she was the person who was worthy of having her favors courted. We also find people, women sometimes, putting up buildings in Roman towns. One of the most prominent buildings just off the Forum at Pompeii, as we'll examine in the next lecture when we look at Roman townships, was erected according to an inscription by a woman called Eumachia. It was a major public building. It was a market. And it's right there at the center of town with an inscription saying that it was put up by a local prominent woman. We hear as well of a woman putting up an amphitheatre and a theatre, both immensely expensive buildings, in the town of Casinum in Italy, putting these buildings up at her own expense. So here's again, she's a person who owns property and is then deploying it for the benefit of the local town and gets an inscription honouring her efforts in that regard. Well, of course, just one example, there are dozens, but I'll give you just one from the town of Cartima in Spain, honouring a woman called Junia Rustica for various benefactions. Clearly a person of some importance. Here's the inscription. Junia Rustica, daughter of Decius, priestess for life and the leading lady in the town of Cartima. She rebuilt the public porticos that were ruined with old age. She gave a plot of land for the bath, paid the taxes of the town, and set up a bronze statue of Mars in the Forum. After giving a public banquet and a spectacle, she gave as a gift at her own expense the porticos near the bath on her own property, along with a pool and a statue of Cupid. After remitting the cost, she made at her own expense and dedicated the statues decreed to herself and her son, Gaius Fabius Junianus, by the local council of Cartima, and she made at her own expense and dedicated a statue to her husband, Gaius Fabius Fabianus. So here's a woman who is laying out considerable outlays, being honoured in return. The local town council says, oh, we're going to erect statues of yourself and your son. A further act of generosity on her part. No, I'll pay for those. And then goes ahead and puts up an extra statue to her husband. Clearly a person of considerable wealth and prominence in her locality. She's mentioned as a priestess, and of course priestesses, basically religion and religious services was one of the few areas where Roman women could enjoy high public profiles. The most famous priestesses of all are the Vestal Virgins in Rome, six of them chosen from among the senatorial order, extremely prominent, independent of all potestas, by the way. They were not under the potestas of anyone. They're automatically independent. They served the hearth of Vesta, the sacred fire of Rome, for 30 years. That was the agreement. And as long as they didn't mess up, they could retire to a considerable degree of prestige and prominence as very respectable women. If they messed up, by the way, if it turned out that they were no longer virgins for whatever reason, then they were buried alive. That was the punishment for breaking your vows as a Vestal Virgin. But all across the empire, priestesses of a variety of cults, not just the Vestal Virgins, who were the pinnacle, I suppose, of female participation in religious affairs, all across the empire, priestesses of all sorts could be prominent in their localities. Eumachia, for instance, the woman who built that building in Pompeii, turns out from the inscription, was a priestess of Venus, the patron goddess of Pompeii. So turning briefly then to the lower orders, the situation would appear to have been quite different. Our sources are so much more limited, though we have seen, for instance, the speech in Livy from Spurius Ligustinus, the soldier who spent 22 of 30 years away in campaign from a half-acre plot of land farmed by his wife and his eight children. There's a woman who must have had a very hard life. Her husband's away fighting everyone that the Romans are fighting in the 2nd century BC, and she's left alone with eight children to farm the land. And relief sculptures, for instance, portray women in shops serving alongside their husbands. And we hear about women, of course, there are prostitutes, courtesans who are very much their own people and run their own shops. We hear of serving maids and tavern owners and so forth. So among the lower orders then, the situation was considerably more diverse. Slave women, of course, would have had it particularly hard, as all slaves would have been, but perhaps more subject to the threat of sexual degradation at the hands of owners than would be the case for male slaves. So we should bear in mind then that the position of lower class women and women in the lower levels of society would have been quite different than that which we focused on in this particular lecture. So to sum up then, the lives of Roman women were quite varied and vibrant, depending on circumstances. We shouldn't be misled by the ancient sources. It's true that legally they were always considered to be subordinate to men, but we've seen that especially in the case of women in local townships and cities around the empire, they could reach positions of some prominence. And in fact, it's to the townships and cities of the empire that we'll turn our attention in the next lecture.
Lecture 41, An Empire of Cities.
Hello and welcome to the 41st lecture in the history of ancient Rome, in which we're going to examine the city, the basic administrative building block of the Roman Empire. The Roman Empire was an empire of cities. The urban element was the repository of all the chief benefits of Roman civilization. Tended to be the place where the elite and the educated classes would congregate despite their avowed connection to the land through their agricultural interests. The focus of many of their endeavours was on the city. The city served an enormous variety of functions which we'll examine in this lecture. And in many ways, and sometimes even expressed by the Romans themselves quite clearly, the city was a manifestation of the majesty of the Roman state. It was above all the urban centre that represented what Rome and the Roman Empire was. The city's most basic function was to run the affairs of every locality in the Roman Empire. If we take the land of the empire as an entity and exclude all that land that wasn't owned by the emperor or by the Roman people, the rest of the land of the empire that was arable, certainly, would have been divided up and assigned to individual townships and cities across the empire. In this way, then, the empire as a territorial entity resembled a quilt of territories assigned to specific municipal centres. The basic shape of the city was like that of the ancient Greek city-state. There would be an urban centre. There would then be a territory of agricultural land which paid taxes to that urban centre and supported it, for which the urban centre served a variety of functions, and I'll look at that, as I say, in due course. But you'd also have in the territorium of a city, you would have villages and smaller towns. If the city was very large and had a very large area, some of those villages and towns could be fairly substantial by ancient standards. If it was small, then those villages might be very tiny, more like hamlets. But within the ambit of the city itself, of the city's territory, would be smaller groupings of buildings, villages and smaller towns, and also estates and farms, small farms owned by smallholders and large estates owned by richer members of the local aristocracy and occasionally people from outside. Senators, for instance, might own land in the territory of some major urban centres. So they might have an estate and a villa located in the territory of certain cities. Each city was considered by the ancient Romans to have its own particular citizenship. Every Roman then who lived in a city or within the ambit of a city was a person who, in Cicero's words, had two homelands. He had the city of Rome and the Roman Empire as the overarching loyalty, and then he also had his affiliation with his local municipality. The populations of these places were by and large quite small. I've talked about the population of Rome in 1st century BC reaching about 1 million. That's an exceptional case and exceptionally large even by the standards of the Roman Empire. The other large cities of the empire would be places like Carthage on the north coast of Africa, numbering perhaps 200,000 people, Alexandria at the mouth of the Nile River, numbering perhaps 300,000, and Antioch over on the coast of the Mediterranean Sea in Syria, the capital of the Roman Empire in the east, and that was perhaps numbered about 300,000 as well. Most of these population estimates are just guesses, but these are the large urban centres, Rome, Carthage, Alexandria, and Antioch. For the most part, the other cities of the empire, and they were extremely numerous, would have had populations in the low tens of thousands, maybe even hovering around the figure 10,000. So we're not talking about very large places, not cities by our standards. We think of cities in terms of millions of inhabitants, or hundreds and hundreds of thousands of inhabitants. Well, by Roman standards, a city was more like what we would consider to be a town. And often the word township is actually a better description of what these places were like.